Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Let's begin today with a tension, one that many of us are feeling during the coronavirus pandemic, the need to keep as many people as possible safe from the virus, and the want to reopen and return to some kind of normal. That tension has started to bubble over in some places around the country, including here in New England, as the shutdowns and stay-at-home orders continue. Over the weekend, some 100 folks turned out at the Bourne Rotary to call for an end to the shutdown, and in New Hampshire, on Saturday, a few hundred people turned up at the State House to protest the Granite State's stay-at-home order. One of that event's organizers is J.R. Hole, a former Republican state representative, and he says it's about saving New Hampshire's economy.
The cure is worse than the disease. We've effectively lost 125,000 jobs in New Hampshire. We see now four hospitals laying off massive staff. So not only do we not see the surge that everybody was worried about, we are now so far away from that that we're in danger of losing our regional hospitals.
And Hole tells us that they'll continue to protest because there are civil liberty tensions at play.
There's an economic side, right, about jobs. There is clearly a constitutional side of this, and I would say the civil liberties falls under there. When people are told that they can't do certain things that the Constitution allows them to do, the right to assemble being one of them, that is of concern.
So let's pick it up there. Are you frustrated with the stay-at-home advisories? Are you concerned about folks not following those advisories and the social distancing guidelines? Can you be feeling both at the same time? And what is the balance between preserving public health and preserving civil liberties? Share your thoughts. What do you think about this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now on the line is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, good to have you back.
Good to be on again.
So, Judge Gertner, your private law practice focused heavily on defending clients against government overreach. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right.
So this is something you've thought a lot about. And I want to start by asking you, there's a lot of variation on actions taken by governors across the country. What is the power of governors to make these decisions? And what do you make of the pushback of the kind that we just heard, you know, a minute ago?
Governors have the, and all public authorities have public health responsibility. And the question is what the, how far that can go. And what's interesting about and troubling about coronavirus is that it is a disease, obviously, of contagion. It's a disease that you could get from someone you don't know, as opposed to AIDS and other diseases like that. So if my neighbor decides to go out in the street and mingle with someone and then decides to help me by delivering my newspaper, I could conceivably get it. It's a disease of contagion where what happens to me is affected by everyone around me.
And does that in some way sort of constitutionally or legally change the rights and abilities of governors on what they can do, what they can impose on their people?
It certainly does. In other words, there is, on the one hand, public health authority, public health obligations. Then the question is whether or not the restrictions, whether or not the rules match the extent of the public health problem. So, for example, I know that in New Hampshire, people protested motorcycle helmets, having to wear motorcycle helmets. And there the public health issue was, if you crack your head up, you're going to go to the local emergency room, and it'll tax our system. Now, that was a much more attenuated relationship than what you have here, which is your virus can wind up getting to me. So the issue is there authority here? Yes. The question is, do you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
The question is the scope of that authority. I said the question is the scope of that authority.
Yeah, I want to go back for a second because it's interesting because I actually had in my mind as one of the things to ask you about a comparison to helmet laws, which feel apt. You talked about HIV/AIDS a minute ago, and you did say you can't contract that from someone you don't know. You actually could, right, through sharing of needles with somebody maybe you didn't know, or there's concern about blood transfusions. It sounds like part of what you're saying is it's the type of contagion that comes from coronavirus, and that actually those things actually affect public policy and what you can and can't do. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's right. I mean, I think that there are lots of ways in which the government regulates health, vaccine laws, helmet laws, regulates what a drug company can do and the distribution of drugs. What was significant about coronavirus, so the scientists told us, is that there can be community transmission here, as opposed to direct, intimate partner transmission. And so if there's community transmission, if it is so easy to catch, then the scope of what the government can do has to match that. It's not enough to say, I should stay in my house. The issue is, my neighbors have to as well.
So doesn't that then, or should it then, I guess I should ask you, put strong demands on the government to roll those things back when the concern about contagion is past? I'm thinking about legitimate concerns about government overreach in times of emergency in the past, maybe the FISA court system after 9/11, for example.
No, I think that's right. I think that your opening was exactly right. There is a danger here. And the danger is that powers that are obtained during a emergency wind up extending beyond the emergency on the one hand, and extending beyond the needs of the emergency. So in some countries, for example, this has extended to the government mining cell phone data in order to trace people's contacts. I was just reading about in Western Australia, rather, the government required that people had tracking devices in their homes if they were contagious. So the question is, how far can the government go? How much can it obtain our personal information? Is it voluntary or involuntary? And does it now go past the needs of the emergency? Those are questions that are legitimate and fair questions to ask.
Judge Gutner, let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Michael on the line. I think you're driving, right, Michael? You're driving in Haverhill?
That's right, yeah. And I just wanted to say, as a reminder to people, your civil liberties won't count for much if you're not healthy. Yeah, they're important, but if you're endangering other people, you infringe on their civil liberties anyway. So taking these precautions to keep yourself safe, to me, is much more important than protesting down in whatever states are doing it.
Thanks for that call, Michael. And to add to that, Judge Gertner, it makes me think, and I'm going to butcher it, the famous quote from Ben Franklin, right, about those who who essentially sacrifice their liberties in order to maintain safety actually get neither. So there is a tension here, the kind that our caller was just talking about.
There is a tension. There's no question about it. But as I said, that means you have to monitor the monitors. But it doesn't necessarily mean they don't have the authority to do this. In fact, I have to say something about this cure is worse than the disease, which is something our president has recited over and over again. The cure here is not to be dead. The cure here is not to be dead, which for a very high percentage of people, the disease here is not to be dead. So the notion of what can we do to prevent deaths, it seems to me is a reasonable question. And given the toxicity, as they say, of this virus, that's something that should be weighed in the balance here rather than my ability to get my nails done.
Let's hear from Governor Baker on that, actually. This is him from yesterday when he was asked about protests against stay-at-home orders. Here's what he said.
This is not like any other virus, and I really hope people recognize and understand why it's so important that people act on these initiatives that we've put in place, why we're grateful that the vast majority of the people in Massachusetts have, and to appreciate that this isn't This isn't being done to punish anybody, okay? It's being done to try to keep people safe, and it's being done based on data and information on an unprecedented virus as we gather it and as it comes together.
So, it strikes me that the governor is consistent in those comments, Judge Gertner, with what you just said. You also brought up President Trump. And one of the things that's been interesting with him over the last week is he has given mixed messages. So first, he tweeted about liberating states like Virginia, Minnesota, Michigan that had strong stay-at-home orders. But last night, he criticized the governor of Florida for opening too soon against federal guidelines. In this time where we have these extreme tensions, how important is transparency and consistency in the communication from those who are using, let's say, exceptional powers in order to keep people safe?
Well, let me start with the consistency. Think about it this way. We don't have a cop on our corner because the police trust that we will follow even an invitation not to go outside. In other words, we trust our health authorities enough that we don't need a drone overhead to enforce when I'm going out and walking the dog. If the president is all over the map about what is appropriate and what is not, it then enables my neighbor across the way to say, well, the hell with this, I don't have to follow it. That leads to two problems. One is the problem that then there will be contagion. And the other problem is then there will be pressure for more forceful measures. And that would be very troubling. That would be very troubling. Right now, we're following it because we all, at least in this state, believe it's important to do.
Last question for you, Judge Gertner. For those who are deeply anxious, not only about civil liberties, but about the need to prevent any more harm than is necessary to people economically, what are the channels and venues appropriate to them to create tension and pushback so that the government does cede back the ability to participate in the economy, I think you understand what I'm saying. What are the right avenues during a pandemic to put that pressure back on your government appropriately?
Well, let me start with the wrong avenue. The wrong avenue is a non-socially distant demonstration on Boston Common. That's the wrong avenue. That's like purposely circulating HIV or doing something to protest a rule with regard to HIV. That doesn't make any sense. So I think there are letters and calls, these programs like this, letters to the editor, letters to the governor. I think those kinds of issues. And if it happens that the regulations outstrip the period of the safety problems, then you go to court. I mean, there really is a question of, what's the recourse if the government continues this longer than it has to, and there's a recourse to the court. But in the short term, we have to monitor using the tools available to us.
That's WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. It was great to have you on today, Judge Gertner. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So listening into that conversation was Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Doron, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
And if you have a question for Dr. Doron about the importance of these guidelines, what we know about the virus at this point, COVID-19 and how it spreads, call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want to hear from you. First, Dr. Doron, I'd love to get your thoughts on what you just heard and the concerns raised about the economy, civil liberties, the pain of the shutdowns versus the pain to public health that would come from not being shut down.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard. I don't want to make light of the suffering that everyone is going through due to the economic shutdown. I think it's really important to remember one thing, and that is something that we all get confused about sometimes. Distancing measures were never meant to make it so that I don't get it, or that you don't get it, because that might be inevitable at some point. They were meant so that you and I and everyone else in the state don't get it all at once or too many at once, so that there are still hospital beds, ICU beds, ventilators available to save my life or your life if we do get the disease.
So does that mean that there's really, short of a vaccine, no way to be sure you don't get it? It's just that we want to make sure that if you do, you can have the healthcare treatment that you need?
Exactly. And it's not even about preventing all deaths, because people are going to die from COVID-19. It's about preventing preventable deaths, especially deaths that will occur because of an overwhelmed medical system. And it's not even all COVID-19 deaths, because this isn't just about COVID-19. If the hospital doesn't have any beds or any ventilators or any ICU capacity, then a person with a heart attack or a stroke can't get treatment either.
So, Dr. Durone, I cover Governor Baker's press conference every day, and from, I don't know, probably close to 10 days now, he's been reporting that the hospital bed capacity in the Commonwealth has hovered at about 50% available, roughly. It comes up and down a little bit. Does that mean that that mission has essentially been accomplished and we are in a situation where we've got the healthcare capacity to keep people from dying unnecessarily due to lack of access to healthcare?
It doesn't really mean that yet. So whereas many hospitals have bed capacity, they may not have, and mine doesn't necessarily have, ICU capacity. And although we've all flexed into our surge plans and opened what we call ICU beds in a lot of other places in the hospital, so we're able to say we have capacity in our surge plan, that doesn't mean that we're not, because we are, taking care of patients, critically ill patients, in areas where we don't normally take care of critically ill patients, using staffing models that are not our usual, using equipment that's really outside of the ordinary. So things are definitely not business as usual here. People are working much longer hours than they should, and our equipment shortages are still a very significant issue, both personal protective equipment and the equipment that we use for critical care.
Dr. Durone, the calls are just flowing in, so let's take a couple. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Jan on the line from Cape Cod. Jan, do you have a question for Dr. Durone?
Hi, yes, thank you. I have noticed from all the different news, print and television, that there hasn't been a good diagram, picture, graph, not a graph, a diagram or a picture showing how this can be transmitted, really clearly in really simplistic everyday terms. I go to the grocery store, I touch something, someone touches it, goes to the post office, they talk with somebody, maybe they didn't have a mask or something, or maybe they touch the front of their mask when they put it on and off, and then, you know, just different things, and then they went somewhere else, and then they were talking, but they weren't far enough. And so the air, you know, just different types of things. I don't know. And I think for various reasons that people, I think there's a disconnect. And many public health initiatives usually involve a behavior modification, a behavior sort of what is it, how, and why. And I feel like they keep saying, do social distance, do this because we're telling you. But people, I think, need that educational component, but I think it's been missing.
Great. Let's turn to Dr. Durone and see if you can you paint that simple picture, Dr. Durone?
I wish it was that simple, actually, because, you know, this is actually one of the many struggles that we all face with the fact that it's a new virus and that there's still a lot that's unknown. Now, what we know is that the primary mode of transmission is what we call droplet and contact. So the majority of infections occur from those large droplets. You cough or you sneeze, and a droplet of mucus, for lack of a better word, ends up in somebody else's mucous membranes, usually their eyes, nose, or mouth, and that's how they get the disease. You could also wipe your nose and touch a surface that somebody else comes along and touches. And those are the primary modes of transmission. And we know that based on a number of things, including looking at how many people become infected from any one given person. That's different than airborne transmission organisms like measles and tuberculosis. I'm sure you've seen in the past, over the years, announcements that if you've been to such and such coffee shop, you've been exposed to measles and you should contact your doctor. That's not going to happen with this disease because it doesn't hang out in the air. That being said, airborne diseases and droplet transmission diseases like COVID-19. It's not as black and white as we wish it would be. And there is some gray zone in between, like you've been hearing lately about maybe somebody who's just talking to you, not actually coughing, could transmit the infection to you. Maybe there are situations in which the infection could travel more than 6 feet. But the majority of the transmission is that 6 foot distance maximum with those larger droplets.
Okay, so that's actually really helpful because the advice we've had over time has changed. First, you don't need to wear a mask. Maybe you do need to wear a mask. Stay 6 feet apart. Maybe 6 feet isn't enough. But it sounds like what you're saying is that when you average it out and you use reasonable safety precautions, that 6 foot distance is a good number.
That's a good way to think of it.
All right. Let's grab one more call while we can. We've got Kara on the line from Martha's Vineyard. Kara, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question on, I'm not sure, because of the unknown, what we do know about being asymptomatic and what that means for how long is someone asymptomatic. And so if I am asymptomatic and I'm unknowingly passing around the disease, how long is someone doing that?
Yeah.
Great question. Dr. Jerome.
Great question. So increasingly, we all have learned the word asymptomatic. That means that you have infection without symptoms. What we know is that there are definitely people who test positive who have no symptoms, and we know that there are people who are pre-symptomatic, which means they test positive and they're about to get symptoms. So both of those categories exist, and also people who test positive and do have symptoms. Now, those asymptomatic people, we believe that they play some role in the transmission of infection, certainly not the largest role, because, again, they're not coughing, they're not transmitting those droplets, they're not wiping their runny noses and you know, touching the escalator because they don't have a runny nose, but they probably play some role. Now, in terms of how long somebody is infectious or contagious when they're asymptomatic or symptomatic, that's one of the big unknowns. What we know is that you can test people over and over and over, and some people will become test negative in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and some people have a positive test for 6 weeks. And they may have no symptoms at all for that entire 6 weeks, but the test positivity does not equate to being contagious because the test only measures the presence of the RNA, the element of the virus that the test was meant to detect, was invented to detect. We don't have a test for contagiousness. And so that remains one of the big unknowns for this virus.
So with that in mind, Dr. Jerome, in our last minute or so, with that uncertainty in mind, what is your message to people out there who are struggling with the tension? They want to be safe. They want to keep others safe. But they're concerned about their employment, their mental well-being, their rights as these shutdowns continue.
All I can say is that, I feel for everyone that's out there, trying to do the right thing and struggling. And everyone is struggling. We are trying to get to a point where we have reached my professional society, the Infectious Disease Society of America, sort of refers to as the three T's: testing, tracing, and treatment. The treatment is what we talked about. We don't have a miracle cure for the disease, but at least having the resources to treat people who need to go to the hospital without an overwhelmed medical system. The testing, having that capacity to actually find out who has it, ramping up testing availability so that people who are sick can all go and get the test. And then the tracing piece is so that every time we detect someone sick, we can find their contacts and quarantine them so we can slow this thing down.
That's Dr. Shira Jerome, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks for joining me and our listeners today on Radio Boston, Dr. Jerome.
Great to be here. Thanks.